Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the CRECA Thursday lecture. My name is Jennifer Tischler, and I'm the Associate Director of CRECA. In a moment, I'm going to call up Manon van de Water, Professor of Theater and Drama, to introduce today's speaker, but I just wanted to make a couple of quick announcements. Number one, spend spring break in Moscow, Russia, studying theater. In cooperation with the Department of Theater and Drama, International Academic Programs is going to be running a one-credit, one-week spring break module on theater in Russia. There's an info session on this on October 26th at 1:15, and there are some flyers in the back, so if you might be interested, or if you're teaching classes with undergraduates and those undergraduates might be interested, I encourage you to take a flyer and to approach Manon with questions about that. Okay. We still have several events coming up in the remainder of the fall semester, so I invite you to take a copy of the CRECA events calendar if you don't already have one. And there's a sign-up sheet circulating, and so if you're not already receiving our email announcements or newsletters, please join the CRECA mailing list. And I think that's all I have in terms of announcements, so I invite Manon van de Water to introduce today's speaker.
Hi, it's my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Anders Petra Couvet. Petra and I actually go way back because we studied together at the University of Leiden. She received her doctoral degree in Russian language and literature in 1988 and with minors in Byzantology and translation studies. And her doctoral thesis was on Anna Prismanova. After that, she worked for a long time as an independent scholar and a translator. She published, she translated, she edited work, and then she became a teacher. And only a few years ago, she decided to go while full-time working to go back and to go on with her PhD. And she is currently writing on, and I will kind of like read that to you, Toppled Cupolas, Heterotopias of Soviet Orthodox Space in Post-Stalinist Poetry.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So this is not what she's going to talk about at all today, but in her translation work, she came across some work that of Pasternak and Dr. Zhivago and made a Dutch connection. That was turned into a television program. It was broadcasted out, and just a few years ago, it got the attention of the journalists of the Washington Post. And she's still working on that, and it will come out in a few years as a book. But I won't talk too much about that because she will do that herself. Among her publications were publications on Leonid Aranzon and Olga Sadekova, on Pasternak, of course, Biela Akhmadulina. And also she did the first translation of Maria Tsvetaeva in Dutch, and that was also published. Translations, Pasternak, Irina Schwartz, Akhmadulina, Gogol, Tsvetaeva, Kostovsky, Nabokov, Tsvetaeva again. So she's well versed in Russian literature and also in Russian poetry. And please welcome Petra Couvet.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy, actually, that CRECA has invited me for this talk. On the list of previous CRECA lecturers, I've seen names like the wonderful poet Yelena Schwartz, whom I admire. And I can only say that I feel honored to add to this row of illustrious predecessors. But moreover, the platform of CRECA provides a good opportunity to bring a rather unknown story for the first time over the ocean. The story that I'm about to tell you is a story about a publication. It's a story that is set in a war during which conflicts were settled not by means of gunpowder and clash of arms, but mental bravado, gutspot, dirty tricks, and cultural weapons like exhibitions, international congresses, world fairs, and the publication of journals and novels. It's a story where the Western secret services and the anti-communist world crossed swords with the Soviet Union in order to show that liberal democracy was not less compatible with culture than communism. It is a story that shows a total mix-up of the mechanics of the making of a novel, manuscript editors, agents, and so on, under the influence of politics. It is a Cold War story. In fact, the story could well qualify for a puppet play featuring a Russian poet, a Soviet villain, an Italian and a Dutch merchant, a French countess, and a Roman clergy, and an invisible canny party who pulls the ropes. At stake was not the honor of a damsel in distress. At stake was a novel. This novel, the first Russian language edition of Pasternak's famous novel, Dr. Zhivago, that appeared in the summer of 1958 in the Netherlands at Mouton and Co. Printers, under very shady circumstances indeed. This first Russian language edition put Mouton and Co., the respectable printer and publishing house, in the quiet city of Den Haag for a moment on the world stage. What had happened? Why did this best-selling Russian novel appear in the Kingdom of the Netherlands? Why Mouton and Co.? And why did it carry the imprint Feltrinelli? You can see it here, Feltrinelli Milan. And why did it came as a surprise to almost everybody involved? And why do I, 51 years later, still feel like talking about it? In the summer of 1997, I was planning to write on Pasternak in Germany when I came across a reference to an alleged first Russian Dr. Zhivago that appeared in the Netherlands. I was intrigued. I forgot about Pasternak in Germany and decided to go and inquire. That same summer, I found several of the people that were involved in the publication story, old but alive in the Netherlands and France. I took interviews, I tried to make it to the archives of the Dutch Secret Service, in vain, and I wrote and published an article that drew the attention of a TV journalist who brought the story on public television. And although I felt that the television show devaluated the integrity of the story in trying to make it accessible to a broad public, it certainly opened up the way to new insights and information. The responses I got after the show helped me write a second article, moving towards a denouement. In the years that followed, I have made some serious attempts to shape the story of me, but each time I decided to call it a day, it bounced back to me. Journalists, scholars, publishers, librarians, adventurists, or just very strange men telephoned me, wrote me with questions, and in doing so brought the story back to me as a dog retrieving. Over the years, the fog that covered the publication story has slowly lifted. The role of the poet, the villain, the countess, the merchant became more clear. But the face of the invisible puppet player yet has to be revealed. But hopefully that will all change soon. Well, the American Slavist and publisher Karl Proffer, maybe you know him, artist publishing, yeah, notes in 1984 that the story on the publication is of less importance compared to the text itself. Yet, in 2009, the publication story seems to have outplayed the novel's plot. After all, who still reads Dr. Zhivago? My guess is, and I'm sorry to say it, and you may contradict it, but my guess is that in the West, and probably more and more in Russia, the novel is hardly read. Although David Lean's 1966 movie, starring Omar Sharif and the wonderful Julie Christie, did and still does a good job preventing the story from being forgotten. Pasternak, together with Akhmatova and Tsvetaeva and Mandelstam, was one of the leading poets of the Silver Age. In the 1940s, he had set himself to write a novel that recounts the life of Dr. Poet Yuri Zhivago against the backdrop of the first decennia of the 20th century, from the 1905 revolution up to the launch of Stalinism. Apart from the Zhivago poems that were published in a journal in 1954, it took years before the novel was released in the Soviet Union. Only in 1988, year of relaxation of censorship, Dr. Zhivago was serialized in Novi Mir, that despite its liberal reputation during the fall, had rejected Dr. Zhivago in 1956. Although my talk will focus on the Dutch side of the story, I do think, in order to remain comprehensive, it is necessary to outline some of the preceding events in brief. And I figure the best way to tell the Dutch story is to follow the track of the two different manuscripts from Moscow to the Netherlands. First, the crude, unrevised manuscript that I will refer to as the Feltrinelli manuscript. And secondly, the corrected and most authoritative one referred to as the Proyar manuscript. Both of them end up in the Netherlands. But let's start with the Feltrinelli manuscript. I've written down some of the events because it's a lot of algebra here, but I need to tell you because, yeah, otherwise it won't be clear. In 1955, Pasternak had finished writing his novel. An unknown number of copies of an unrevised manuscript circulated in Moscow. In the winter of 1955, Pasternak submitted the novel to different publication channels, such as Novi Mir, as earlier mentioned, and the state publisher Godlies Izdat. But by the spring of 1956, Pasternak had still not received any reaction. Not so surprising, since Pasternak's poetic truth shows the downsides of the revolutions, war, communism, and exudes an overtly Christian symbolism. And yet, at the time, it was not so naive of Pasternak to think that a novel as controversial as Dr. Zhivago stood the chance of being published in the Soviet Union. Khrushchev's secret speech in February 1956 at the 20th Party Congress denouncing Stalinism had brought vigilant optimism. That summer, rumors were going that an independent publishing house was set up. But the defeat of the Hungarian uprising in autumn 1956 brought a sudden halt to the atmosphere of freedom, initiative, and making plans. In May 1956, there had been rumors of a planned publication of Dr. Zhivago in Russia and abroad. Sergio D'Angelo, a young correspondent working for the Italian section of Radio Moscow and representative of a young communist Italian publisher, Feltrinelli, decides to visit Pasternak at his dacha in Peredelkino, the writer's village southwest of Moscow. At the end of their talk, he presents Pasternak with a plan to publish an Italian translation of the novel at Feltrinelli's. Should the novel be accepted in the USSR, what harm could an Italian translation do at a communist publisher abroad? But Pasternak was not so sure. Handing over the manuscript, he expresses his anxious foreboding. "You are, as of now, invited to my execution," he says. In June 1956, this uncorrected manuscript is at Feltrinelli's in Milan. June 13th, an agreement between Feltrinelli and Pasternak is signed. And although the agreement is focused only on the Italian translation, it grants Feltrinelli various rights that Pasternak, not familiar with the international copyright law, is not aware of, and that ultimately will give Feltrinelli control over all editions in the West except for the Russian edition published in the USSR. However, at the moment Pasternak hands over his manuscript, he is still hoping for a Soviet publication. And in January 1957, a contract is signed between Pasternak and Godlies Izdat. Feltrinelli is informed that Godlies Izdat plans to bring out an abridged, re-censured edition in the fall in the Soviet Union and is subsequently asked to wait with the publication of the Italian translation. Feltrinelli sets the beginning of September as the latest date for the Italian translation. Of course, this contract was more phony than real. Soviet officials were trying to regain control over the uncensored manuscript and hold the Italian translation. And then finally, in the summer of 1957, state officials decide not to publish for ideological reasons. Thereby, the Writers' Union considers Pasternak to be a traitor and a gold digger trying to make a fortune in the West. Pasternak is persuaded to send out a telegram to Feltrinelli asking to suspend the publication. Feltrinelli, however, sees what the Union is up to and goes ahead with his plans. The president of the Union, the Writers' Union, Surkov, travels to Italy to convince Feltrinelli not to publish and to try to retrieve the manuscript with the help of the Italian Communist Party. Feltrinelli, however, sticks to his guns and releases the novel in November 1957 in an edition of 6,000 copies that are sold out the very same day. And because this Italian translation is the first publication of the novel in the world, Feltrinelli gains control over all rights of the novel in the West. In November 1957, publication in the Soviet Union seemed a bridge too far. In March 1958, Pasternak is shortlisted for the Nobel Prize, but the Nobel Committee allegedly requires nominated novels to be evaluated in the original language. Without Zhivago in Russian, Pasternak risks the chance to miss out on his Nobel Prize once again. And then, somewhere along the way, an invisible hand intervenes. This is Feltrinelli, so the Italian publisher. A few months later, the Feltrinelli manuscript turns up in New York. The American side of the Zhivago affair is passed on by Karl Proffer. He writes how at the end of 1957, the American publisher and Trotsky's Felix Morrow is approached by a woman who is charged by the CIA with what Morrow calls an astonishing and attractive task. That woman is Elsa Poretsky. That's her. Widow of the previous Comintern secret agent, Ignaz Reis. I don't know if you're familiar with Ignaz Reis. He was murdered by the Gepu, and in the plot was the husband of Marina Tsvetaeva was involved there, Sergei Fromm. He didn't kill him, but you know, he was involved. She started to work for the CIA to revenge her husband's murder by the Gepu. The highly attractive task concerns the typesetting of Dr. Zhivago in a Russian typeface that is unusual for the US. The typeset novel is to be brought to Europe and, as Proffer guesses, to be printed on European paper so as to wipe out all the traces to America. The printed copies are to be distributed on the World's Fair that was held that year in Brussels, from the pavilion of the Holy Chair, the Vatican. Russian copies of Dr. Zhivago are to be handed out to the Soviet tourists. That was the plan. Morrow has the novel typeset by Rausen Brothers in New York and agrees to find a printer in Europe. And according to Proffer, Morrow is advised to find one in the Netherlands. But then, all of a sudden, the CIA puts a brake on the project, stops investing money. What has happened? Why is that? Before we go any further, one of the key questions is, of course, where did the CIA get the Zhivago manuscript? Proffer writes that Morrow recalls his CIA informant saying that he got the manuscript through the British Secret Service. This is really James Bond now. Allegedly, during Feltrinelli's return flight from Moscow to Milan, MI6 agent had arranged an emergency landing at Malta during which the manuscript was photographed. Malta at that time, here's Malta, you can see it there. Yeah, it's very, very small, but it was a part of the United Kingdom and it was known to be a strategic point for the British Secret Service. But despite the fact that it is a very vital link in the story, it remains up till now unsubstantiated. And yet, it is a very persistent story. I had it confirmed by almost all the people that I interviewed. But what is fact and what is flannel? First of all, there was no flight from Moscow to Milan. From Feltrinelli's scout, D'Angelo, we know that he gave Feltrinelli the manuscript in Berlin. And another thing is that a lot of manuscripts circulated in Moscow in 1955, and they might have gotten it through other channels. Therefore, it is very feasible that the story was intentionally spread by the CIA to throw dust into our eyes, to wipe out traces, as a strategic part of the plan. Why should they, after all, tell somebody where they got the manuscript? Smokescreen policies, that is. Okay, and then, last year, in November 2008, in Moscow, a book appeared by Ivan Tolstoy. He's the grandson of Alexei Tolstoy, the famous writer of fairy tales and fantastic stories. Tolstoy works as a journalist for Radio Free Europe in Prague. In his book, he tells how he, in 1989, in Munich, met the typesetter Georgi Danilov. Danilov worked in the 1950s for ZOPE, Centralnye Objedinjenie Politicheskih Imigrantov iz SSSR, one of the many, many cover organizations founded by the CIA after the war. Danilov explains to Tolstoy that he had done the typesetting himself in Munich from a manuscript with a bunch of mistakes that leads Tolstoy to conclude that this must have been the Feltrinelli manuscript. But what had happened to the Morrow typesetting? What had happened to the CIA in the US? Why did the CIA not go through with that? Proffer writes that Morrow did not get any further instructions from the Russian section of the CIA. The reason for the delay was that Morrow called in some Russian emigres to clean up the sloppy manuscript. The typesetting was now more correct than the Feltrinelli manuscript, which made it retraceable to the US and politically suspect. Still, Morrow did not know that, and he always believed that he had fulfilled his assignment. Up to this point, we have been tracing the uncorrected Feltrinelli typescript on its journey to the West, directed by an invisible hand. The manuscript had been typeset twice, once in the US, but nothing came from that, and in Munich, another was typeset and made ready to be printed. Meanwhile, in Moscow, things had not come to a standstill either. A proofread authorized manuscript of the novel was made ready in 1956 by the famous poet and editor-in-chief of Novy Mir, Simonov. This is the manuscript that Jacqueline Poyard, French countess and Slavist, finds in the kitchen of the Scriabin Museum in Moscow by accident, a thick book with a blue cover. She is only allowed to read a bit because the manuscript was meant for somebody else. But when she gets the chance to visit Pasternak in Perejelkine on New Year's Day, she's eager to go. They quickly develop a friendship, and upon her return to France, Pasternak entrusts de Proyar with two tasks: the French translation and the Russian language edition in the West. Back in Paris, de Proyar contacts Gallimard publishers for the translation. Three microfilms of the manuscripts are made. De Proyar contacts Mouton & Co., the Dutch academic publisher, for a Russian edition. Well, Mouton & Co. Do you know Mouton & Co., any of you? Yeah? Well, I guess that in the post-war years, especially the 60s and the 70s, almost every Slavic scholar in the Western world was familiar with Mouton. Established in 1953, Mouton was essentially the creative child of Roman Jakobson, famous linguist and Harvard professor, the Dutch Slavist Kees van Schoneveld, who at that time held a post as professor in Leiden, but was assigned in 1966 as a professor at Bloomington. And last, Peter de Ridder, who was in charge of the practical management of Mouton & Co. This is van Schoneveld. Can you see him a little? And this is de Ridder at his home in Lisse. Cities as Janua Linguarum and Slavic printings and reprintings were as of 1950 solid and important means of publication for every writing Slavist, both in the West and the Soviet Union. Books in blue cloth with bright colors accommodated reprints of established names as Gogol, Kosma Prudkov, Yesenin and Anyinsky, but also launched standard works as Old Church Slavonic Grammar by Horace Lanz, or Chomsky, Syntactic Structures, and Viktor Ehrlich, Russian Formalism. That was Mouton's bestseller. Well, back in France, de Proyard writes Mouton and Co. A meeting is arranged on December 12, 1957, in Paris. Except for de Proyard and her husband, de Ridder and van Schoneveld are present. But in November 1957, in the wake of the Italian edition, Feltrinelli had sent out a warning to all Western publishers that he did not allow them to publish a Russian edition. And that message dampens the enthusiasm of the Dutch. Besides, Professor van Schoneveld is concerned that publication would endanger the position of Mouton's Soviet authors. At the time, he told me, "A novel didn't fit in my series. And moreover, at that time, I had the idea that I could make a difference by giving Soviet linguists the chance to gain some reputation in the West that gave them a position in the homeland. And then I had the choice. On the one hand, we had Mr. Pasternak, who at the end of his life wanted to go to Canossa. And on the other hand, we had a number of Soviet authors with whom we wanted to build up and maintain a constructive relationship." Dr. Zhivago would appear eventually, a famous poet, a sensational novel, but it would harm Mouton. I didn't want to sabotage it, but I wasn't positive about it either. However, they take one of the three microfilms home to the Netherlands. On the way home, they get caught in a road accident, but finally they and Dr. Zhivago make it home hitchhiking. Meanwhile, the Proyard, in Ethiopian language, keeps Pasternak apprised of the sheep project. Mouton means sheep in French. And he urges her, in case an agreement is reached with Feltrinelli, to make haste with the Russian language edition. So, Dr. Zhivago, on microphone, is landed in the Netherlands in December 1957, waiting to appear with Mouton and Co. academic publishers. And please note, this is very important, there was a clear distinction between Mouton publishers and printers. Mouton publishers was established as a separate entity alongside the printing business. And then, July 1958, Mouton and Co. printers receives a printing order for a Russian novel by telephone. The person on the phone does not say his name. A meeting is arranged in the city center of Den Haag. The representative of Mouton and Co. printers asks Peter de Ridder, you remember him? This man, asks Peter de Ridder to accompany him to see what it's about, for he could read Russian. They are picked up at Mouton's and brought to an imposing building at the Prinsessengracht in the political heart of Den Haag City. In the hallway, a neatly dressed gentleman is waiting for them who does not want to reveal his identity. He is in the possession of a typeset novel, big sheets, photo negatives, that only need to be printed, he says. Peter de Ridder instantly sees that it concerns Dr. Zhivago. A gold mine, he thinks. But the anonymous gentleman would not hear of it. The printing order involves just 1,000 copies, not more. And so, less than 2 months later, August 24, 1958, the first Russian language edition of Dr. Zhivago is rolling down the printing press. Blue hardcover, size doesn't matter, and stitched. What had happened? Who was the mysterious gentleman? What was his purpose? And why just 1,000 copies? Why, last but not least, did the Ritter, who was, after all, engaged in negotiations with the Proyar for Mouton publishers, granted his sanctions to this edition without the knowledge of Pasternak, de Proyar, and Feltrinelli? That did not seem to cut eyes. As I already... Well, this is the Netherlands. And this is Den Haag. That's where it all happened. Okay. As I already mentioned earlier, after the story was brought on television, I was called up by a paper journalist who introduced me to a former Dutch secret agent who was involved with the psychological warfare. A vibrant old boy, Kees van de Heuvel. That's him. I looked him up in his home in the outskirts of Den Haag on several Friday afternoons, and he confirmed me that the CIA was the principal initiator and sponsor of the Zhivago project, who saw the novel as an excellent weapon in cultural warfare. A novel, he said, that had to stir up anti-Soviet sentiments and had to corrode the fate of the comrades. The Netherlands and the US had been building up strong ties over the years through successful operations in the past, especially the war, of course, and the Dutch Secret Service and the CIA cooperated closely. The CIA was very active in the Netherlands and ran an important station in Den Haag. In 1958, the year of the Zhivago publication, some 50 out of almost 700 Dutch Secret Service agents were paid by the CIA. In order to prevent anyone from noticing the CIA involvement, the printing order was done in Europe, in a country that hardly had any Russian emigrants and was very neutral, the Netherlands. The Dutch Secret Service, on its turn, was asked to find an external executor. An important anti-communist organization in Europe was Peace and Liberty, one of the stay-behind organizations that independently worked to limit the range of influence of communism in the West. In practice, that came down to bringing out a ceaseless stream of anti-communist propaganda. The Dutch branch was founded in 1951. In the Netherlands, a smokescreen covered the role of the Americans in regards to peace and liberty. But facts, mostly from communist sources, show that the director of Peace and Liberty visited the American embassy upon several occasions. The neatly dressed mystery man that had ordered the 1,000 copies came from Peace and Liberty. In fact, it concerned the director of the Dutch branch, a retired army major, Rudy van der Beek. And so, Mouton & Co., the solid, respectable publishing and printing firm, is caught up in a web of espionage and intrigue with a high content of Tanta in the land of the Soviets. In the summer of 1958, two tracks lead to Mouton. From Paris, a corrected Proyar manuscript is submitted for publication to Mouton publishers, but negotiations are in a deadlock because Feltrinelli is breaking up with the Communist Party and is utterly silent. Without his permission, nothing can be done since he owns all the novel's rights in the West. Mouton Printers, on the other hand, is dealing with a mysterious order to print the photonegatives of the uncorrected Feltrinelli manuscript. Feltrinelli does not know about this order, which makes it into an illegal pirate edition. The Ritter, excited and slightly nervous over what happened, passes the story on to his reporter friend. The latter blows his gaff in an article in the De Haag Post, a leading liberal weekly. This article pulls off a stream of orders from all over the world. In less than 5 weeks' time, another 2,000 copies are ordered, whereas the anonymous order requires just 1,000 copies. When Feltrinelli gets wind of the Dutch pirate edition, he's inflamed with anger and demands that the printing process is put to a stop. He thinks Mouton is pulling him a leg. Through the intervention of a lawyer, a settlement is reached. Mouton is allowed to go through with the printing order while binding itself to put the imprint Feltrinelli on the title page. And so, let me see. Yeah. The pirate edition seems to have appeared with two different title pages. One that goes without the imprint Feltrinelli, that concerns the printing order of Peace and Liberty that was financed by the CIA, and one that has the imprint Feltrinelli Milan on the title page, which is for commercial use. This is the one. That's my copy. I got one. And so that was for commercial use and for just a limited edition of 2,000 copies. The preface that is added is written in a rather peculiar Russian. Up to now, it remains unclear who wrote the preface. Whoever made the negatives must have known about the anonymous writer of the preface. Someone in Munich, maybe in England, some emigre, we don't know. And then, copies are collected on September the 6th at Mouton's by the Dutch secret agent Joop van der Wilde in a rented car and brought to his CIA contact. All was paid for by the CIA, a man of the American embassy. Then the trek leads to Brussels, where the copies are distributed among Soviet tourists at the World's Fair. The wife of Roman Jakobson says that she saw a Russian-speaking priest in the pavilion of the Holy Chair, located opposite the Soviet pavilion, slipping Soviet tourists copies of the novel. That was the way the pirate edition was distributed, until October 19, when the fair was closed. In a report of the Holy Chair's participation in the fair, Father Jan Joos sums up the activities of the apostolate in and outside the pavilion in detail. He writes that as soon as the news got out that Soviet tourists that were carried from Leningrad by packet boat in truckloads of 5 times 800 were allowed to visit the Vatican pavilion, a working group was established called Pro Russia Christiana that was charged with welcoming and touring around of Soviet visitors. A bookstore was set up where books, brochures, journals in Russian were obtainable for free. And please note for free, because the committee had learned that the Soviet government had given each Soviet tourist 400 francs, that was about 10 US dollars, to spend. So they couldn't buy it, so that was for free. And in a separate paragraph, Father Joos describes which publications were distributed among the Soviet tourists. Except for Russian Bibles, psalm books, and Christian propaganda as Thoughts Over the Sputnik and Our Atheist Ride, he also includes a list of Russian classics, Berdyaev, Ilyin, Dostoevsky, Solovyov, and he concludes, "We also received copies of modern works as Dudintsev, Not by Bread Alone, and only recently the novel Dr. Zhivago, whose Christian tenet might open new perspective to our Soviet visitors." The Russian edition was now available and smuggled into the Soviet Union and apparently read and evaluated in Stockholm. Pasternak receives the Nobel Prize on October 23 in 1958. That's tomorrow, 51 years ago. And is forced, under heavy pressure of the Soviet state, to refrain from it only 3 days later. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the decisive factors in the making of the Russian language edition was the requirement of the Nobel Prize Committee that the novel should be published in the original language. That fact was revealed by the Proyar. Ivan Tolstoy, in his recent publication, calls this into question. A member of the Swedish Academy states in a 2007 letter to him that the committee's conditions of the original language is unlikely. If there were no such requirements, the question remains why the novel was printed in such haste. One plausible reason might have been that the World's Expo, the perfect and spectacular channel of distribution, was about to be closed on October 19th. Yet one of the questions that puzzles me is, where did the Nobel Committee stand in this? As one of the most prestigious and also one of the mysterious organizations that was dealing with culture, were they under the influence of the CIA during the Cold War? Facts seem to contradict that. For instance, in 1971, Pablo Neruda, the communist and outspoken Stalin adherent, received the Nobel Prize, something that the CIA certainly would not have approved of. Shortly after Pasternak had been awarded the Nobel Prize and had been forced to reject it, emotions were running high in the Soviet Union and in the West. After the publication of the pirate edition, Mouton and Co. had to do some serious explaining. On a Sunday morning in November, the world press was gathered in Hotel d'Azande in Den Haag to hear the official statement. As we learn from the New York Times reporting, Fred Eekhout, managing director of Mouton and Co., said that his publishing house had filled an order that seemed innocent of political aspect, but was distressed to learn propaganda use may have been made of it. In the meanwhile, Roman Jakobson, in his correspondence with Van Schoneveld, looks rather discontented with the course of events. In a letter that is kept in Leiden University Library, Jakobson not only shows his concerns about Pasternak's fate, but also about the relationship between Slavic scholarship in the West and the one behind the Iron Curtain. November 6th, he writes to Kees van Schoneveld, "I am very unhappy about the Pasternak development and about Mouton's stupid involvement in the mess. I, and not only I, consider that these are very dangerous, that this is a very a serious danger in Eastern Europe with these statements and the facts behind them, that might be easily misused by the adversaries of Pasternak, of us, and of the cultural liberalization of the East and cultural cooperation with the West. They seriously endanger our common work, Cornelius and my position, and the future of those Eastern European colleagues who collaborate with us." Well, that was Roman Jakobson. And this was the story of a publication. It is a story that is steeped into tales and cities. It's driven by hidden forces, hidden political agendas, by people's impulses and people's indecisiveness. As for the Dutch merchant, how to evaluate the role of the Dutch, especially De Ridder's role? Heroic, in that he made things happen, you know, the book was published because of him, or was it, as De Ridder later told me, just a printing order with some consequences, the Nobel Prize? Or was it a blunder, to use the words of Roman Jakobson, in that it affected Mouton's impeccable reputation and their neutral political stance? And as for the invisible hand, the role of the CIA, if you see it as a game, a way to play the Soviets a nasty trick, sure, the CIA won that game. I mean, a forbidden book, of course, in the Soviet Union, smuggled into the Soviet Union, and a Nobel Prize, and with a little help of the Vatican as distributor, sure, they won. Pasternak got his Nobel, but suffered the consequences, and died not long after in 1960. What did he think about this? We don't know. We don't know if he knew the Russian of the Dutch language edition. We have not any evidence. And another thing is, did the CIA intervention inflate the novel's prestige? I mean, that's something that the Russians still talk about. They see it as a taboo and they don't want to talk about it. And as for me, well, I hope the invisible hand will be revealed. And hope there is. Last summer, a journalist of the Washington Post came to visit me. He plans to write the definite book on the Zhivago affair. he sent in a formal application to the CIA for all materials relating to, this, to the Pasternak affair. Let's hope the invisible master will emerge from the files to stop all speculation and at last, so that we can go back to what really matters, the novel itself. Thank you very much. Well, I hope you didn't get lost here. If you have any questions, I will try to answer them. Yeah?
Yeah, well, first of all, I hope that he doesn't just get back from the CIA a stack of black paper where everything's been crossed off.
Yeah, well, I met him on Tuesday, actually, in New York. And, you know, it's such an old case that we think, what's the problem?
Right.
But if there are still people alive, you know, that were involved with the case, then you won't get the material.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a problem I also had in the Netherlands. I had two problems. All the CIA files are not in the Netherlands. They're kept, of course, in the US, so I can't see anything. But all the people that were involved were still alive. So I couldn't make it to the archives. And we need substantial evidence, you know, and... But I really hope, and I'm going to burn a candle for him, that he will get all the material and he'll write a thick book and it will be closed.
I have two more points. The correct English translation is Holy See, not Holy Chair.
Oh, okay.
I think that must be a literal translation.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And what else was I going to say? The CIA did subsidize the publication of some books where I think there's no doubt. I'm familiar with two of them. They're not very well known, and they're both about China. One is Eighth Moon, and the other is Escape from Red China. They're both about refugees that fled from China and their experiences and the part of their life when they were in China. And I think it's acknowledged that the CIA sponsored those.
Oh, they sponsored a cultural organization in 35 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And... I don't know if you're familiar with the complete works of Mandelstam and Akhmatova that were brought out in Michigan. You know that? That was also partly sponsored by the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Chekhov, a publishing company, do you know that, in New York? They did some... they did reprintings, actually. And they were fully sponsored by the CIA. Yeah, well, the CIA did a lot. There's a very interesting book on this. It's called The Cold Cultural War by Frances Saunders. She's English, and she wrote about this. But it was in China, that's interesting, but also in Indonesia, where there was a communist government, of course. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really curious about what's in the preface?
Well, it's a strange preface because there's hardly anything in it. You know, you don't get a grip on it. And it's like, well, Pasternak is from a very good family, and his mom and dad this and that, and this is a book that is very interesting and so on. And then it ends that this book is forbidden. So that's interesting, and that three translations already came out. So that's where we can locate it in time. You know, that's the only thing that really you get a grip on. But it's air actually. There's nothing much in there. It's very Wikipedia like. You know, if I may say something. Yeah.
Why did you say the title of the book was again about CIA involvement?
The Cultural Cold War.
Fine.
By Frances Saunders. Fine. Saunders, yeah. And I don't know, it came out not so long ago, but it's so interesting. And she tried to make it to the CIA archives, and she didn't succeed at it. No. Well, you seem to be familiar with that.
Well, I'm familiar with the question
of
trying to obtain material under the FOIA, and it's very frustrating.
Yeah, it is.
And often people do get, like what I said, just black pieces of paper because everything is crossed off.
I just got some from the Dutch Secret Service just two weeks ago. We got something, And they said, well, you get 14 pages with paraphrases. And I was really, I thought, well, I can decode that, you know, I can do that. But there was just nothing in it. So they give things and you don't have anything, you know. I was so disappointed. And yet we're so surprised because it's so long time ago, you know. What's the deal about it? Any more questions? Yeah, oh, sorry.
Yes. Who's the Washington Post reporter? Who's going to do
Peter Finn.
Peter Finn.
Yeah, he writes now on Guantanamo. And he was Moscow correspondent up till 2008.
From what year till 2008?
From 2004 till 2008. Yeah. Yeah.
And has he had any articles in the Post about
Yeah,
this?
He had in 2007. He wrote actually about the publication of Ivan Tolstoy. That's how he came across it. And then somebody in the Netherlands, a journalist, informed him that I had been writing about it. Mm-hmm. And then he was on my doorstep.
I have another question. Have you spoken to Pasternak's son about this?
I didn't speak about it, mm-hmm. but Peter did.
Peter
but he that. Is not happy with all this. That's something, you know, it's strange. I teach for 3 months sometimes. Well, each year I teach three months in Moscow, and I never talk about this. Because people feel so awkward about it, they feel uneasy about it, and they just do this gesture, you know, this typical Russian gesture. No, don't want to talk about it. And I just don't want to embarrass them, you know. So, but Peter did, and he's a journalist, you know, I'm just a very polite lady from the Netherlands, so I don't dare to do that. But he did, of course, Yevgeny doesn't like it. It's really the thing, and I still don't have a good standpoint about it. Do I think that the novel's prestige, because the novel was sponsored by the CIA. Do I think that that makes the quality less, you know? I don't think that. I just don't think that. I keep looking for it, but I don't, well, you know, it appeared and it was Cold War and it was, I don't know what you think about it.
Yeah, I don't understand the big deal of the CIA was backing us either, given the cultural context.
I can understand that
Yevgeny Borisovich might be upset because in the Russian context it would be embarrassing.
Very embarrassing. Because they feel, you know, state and culture always have been at odds, you know, that shouldn't interfere. And that's what they feel so hard about. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the state. And the state is something you have to, you know, be away from. And so, no, they don't like to talk about it. And that's what I like about the Tolstoy book, that he actually, you know, wrote about it and made it public, and so that's good. Yeah. Yes.
I was going to mention another book that nobody reads anymore. It's called "Will the Soviet Union Survive Until 1984?"
Yeah.
The reason I mention that is because didn't the author of that go into exile into the Netherlands?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's the whole story. Yeah, our professor, he was actually friends with Amalric, and he supported him. Yeah, yeah. But I don't know. I don't know any CIA involvement there or money or.
No, but Amalric went in, you know, instead of becoming what Carol van Dreven, our professor, really wanted, which was like this sort of like, you know, scholar in intellect university, he went on all these public lectures and found his fortune.
Yeah.
Well,
that's true.
And then got in a car accident.
Yeah, that's true.
And so much of what
there's
he wrote
a whole,
turned out
to be
prophecy.
Yeah.
Another question: Have you seen any of the 1,000 copies the without the Feltrinelli imprint? Do you know where some of them are?
I didn't see that one up till now. I was very when I published my first article, I never saw the book. Mm-hmm. And there were people in Amsterdam saying, oh, this woman, she doesn't know, and there's no, you know. And then, after the television show, I met this this contact, this secret agent, and he gave me the book. I was so lucky because I thought, well, I'm talking here about something that I've actually never seen, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. So I felt when I came on television, nobody really wanted to say, oh yeah, there was the CIA involved. So they picked me and I had to say it, you know? Well, it was CIA involved. But Professor von Schoneveld didn't want to say it, and the Ritter, nobody, the Proyar, didn't want to say it. So they said, well, you go on television. Yeah, yeah, it must have been the CIA. And I felt so clumsy. And then after that, I noticed that, you know, I got the book. Mm-hmm. But the other ones, the ones that were distributed by the Vatican, mm-hmm. they must have ended up, of course, in Russia. Mm-hmm. And I checked in the house in Perejelkino, mm-hmm. you know, went through the books. Wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I asked, you know, wasn't there. Asked other people in Perejelkino. So I still want to look for that. No. So if anybody comes across it, please.
This reminds me of the publication story behind Master and Margarita, a little bit.
If there's a publication story about...
No, it reminds me of the story
the behind,
behind Master and Margarita.
Yeah.
And I think it was also not allowed to be published until 89, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Novi Mir, in that, you know, reading, I think the whole Soviet Union must have been reading in 1988, because everything came out, you know? It was so exciting. I wasn't there, I was in 1990, and it was all, everything was in the street, and people were reading, everything came out. It was wonderful, really, yeah. And that must have been Novi Mir as well, yeah? Master and Margarita.
And there were a lot of copies circulating in especially in Moscow,
yeah.
In Master
Margarita sometimes. Yeah. And you had at that time you also had
French poet.
No, but at that time you also had a lot of publishing houses, you know, in Minsk or Petrozavodsk and strange, you know, cities somewhere, and they were also publishing, so you could find all kind of copies on that. Yeah.
I was also going to say, as I understand it, Pasternak's grave in Moscow was extensively visited by his fans.
Yeah. That was it was so he was buried in Perejelkino, of course, and it wasn't announced, but it was announced with little notes at Kievsky Vokzal, the Kiev
station,
right? And so it was rumored, so lots of people went there, and it was also very interesting because there it was not just the elite, it was not just the intelligentsia, but just workers, mm-hmm. and they, I've heard about this man, he must have been a great man, and so everybody just went there, and it was a happening. I always ask people, you know, old people, were you at the funeral? And but nowadays, I always visited his grave, when I'm in Moscow, but now I found it that there's no flowers anymore, and you know they have the old Jewish tradition to put stones on the grave. There's no stones anymore on the grave, so it's a little deserted now. So that's also why I have the feeling that it's forgotten. And if I ask my students in Moscow, well, do you know? I said I remember saying, "Вот жизнь не поле перейти," you know, a very famous kind of line. And they said, "What? Who's that?" I said, "That's Pasternak." Oh yeah, Mandelstam. No, Pasternak is that, and that's really frustrating. But that's just my impression, you know. I have no idea if that's general.
But do you have any information or indication? I mean, what happened with those copies, those Russian language copies that the Soviet tourists were then, we assume, taking back with them to the Soviet Union? Was it just like a little, you know, like a pebble in the water, or they just disappeared? Or
no, I know, actually, I know that from one or two people that they had a copy. Mm-hmm. But the strange thing is that I haven't heard of people saying, well, at that time I read Dr. Zhivago, mm-hmm. but you know the poems of Yuri Zhivago already appeared, mm-hmm. and there were lots of manuscripts, so people could have also read it from the manuscript, you know, mm-hmm. so people were familiar with it. But I never met just like somebody who said, oh yeah, I already at that
time I got that blue copy
and
we passed it on to so and so.
No. I know that, well, two people I heard it from, Imperi Delkino, who actually knew and held the copy, and that's why I thought, well, Pasternak must have seen it, but I don't have any evidence. No. But it's very interesting to find that out. Yeah.
Another question. Is de Croyant still alive?
She's the only one, well, yeah, she's the only one alive, because de Ridder, you know, the Dutch, he died 2 weeks ago. Yeah, that was very sad.
Oh,
Van Schoneveld died a few years ago. And then, who else died? Somebody else. Yeah, the Secret Service man, you know, the builder, also died. So most of the Dutch protagonists died, but the Proyaar is still alive.
And what does she have to say?
Well,
you can imagine how upset she would have been after.
The Proyaar was really upset, and I spoke to her in 1989 or 1990, because of the television show. And then it was the first time she saw somebody of Mouton Publishers, because we took him with us. And she said, oh, well, Kees van Schoneveld, we still have to talk about that manuscript. And that was so long. I mean, that they had. And he said, yes, yeah, sure, go and sit. And then they had to really talk it out, because after that, they never saw each other anymore. And another thing, an interesting thing, is what happened to the microfilm. Because there was this microfilm in the Netherlands, and allegedly Kees van Schoneveld said that he had it in a safe. But the whole Mouton, all the Mouton archives were destroyed. That's something that is also very curious. I mean, it was destroyed. Because that's how I started my research, by writing and asking them, where are the Mouton archives? Because I thought, well, then I can see. They were destroyed. And when I asked them, why were they destroyed? Yeah, you know, doesn't say anything to anybody. Yeah. And that's something I told Peter Finn, that I think that's still something that we have to do some research on, because that's strange. So it might have been, and I'm a little afraid to say this, but it might have been that Mouton also was more or less sponsored, might have been, and I'm afraid a bit to say this, but I have the feeling, you know, after all these years, that Mouton wasn't so innocent. But that's my guess, and I that's my guess. I don't know, but we just have to look into that, and I'm just hoping that the CIA will come through.
Peter, what happened with the Fratinelli copyright issue?
Well, that's something that's so complicated. That's really what happened was, well, you have this whole story, of course, with Ivinskaya and Zinaida, the two wives of Pasternak. Do you know that? No.
Well,
Pasternak.
Have to go too far.
Well, it's very complicated. So Pasternak had a formal wife, an official wife, and he had a mistress. So, yeah, I'm sorry to say it, guys, but that's true. And the trouble was that the mistress was actually dealing and in contact with Feltrinelli. And Zinaida, his official wife, was not happy about this whole affair, because she also had to protect her family. I mean, it was a real serious case. And then Ivinskaya, well, there's people that say that she was in for the money. I don't know that, but she was in for the money. And I think Feltrinelli always, and D'Angelo too, they always had contact. But what I heard later, because there was a lot of rumor and investigation about that, but what I heard was that part of the money, so Feltrinelli kept all the money from the rights, you know, and then part of it went to Zinaida and part of it went to Ivinska. That's
and
what I heard.
And then Dupuyar's edition was the one that was printed at the University of Michigan, right? The clean.
Yeah, but I still, yeah, that was the official one. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So the fear that this kind of scandal would ruin Mouton and Company's reputation. Do you think
did that end up turn out to be founded? I mean, in the long term?
No, it's very, because I read, so we have these this correspondence between Jacobson, who's really angry, and Hans Groeneveld, and he was so afraid that the correspondence with the Soviet authors could be intercepted. You know, he was afraid that that would stop. But it turned out that everything was fine. Yeah, so nothing happened of the sort. It just could, you know, they received manuscript from the Soviet Union and they just published on. So it was just fear. Mm-hmm. It's just fear, yeah. Nothing happened, no. But it's strange too, because there's lots of rumors also about Roman Jakobson, where he stood politically. Mm-hmm. Van Schoneveld too, he was a member of the NTS, which is an emigre organization, political. But I don't know if he was still active at that time. There's a lot of things about it. Yeah. I guess every Slavist at that time was political. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Anything to do with Eastern European studies, mm-hmm. very strong.
You always had to have a stand.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Even, but the strange thing is that they all directly said to me, "Oh no, I'm apolitical. You know, I'm really apolitical. I don't have anything to do with it. We just wanted to publish books." But that's not the truth. Mm-hmm. They were all, in a way, they were caught up, you know, somewhere in this web, and they had, there were anti-communists, that was clear, Van Schoneveld and de Ridder. They were, I think, really anti-communist. But Jacobson, we don't know about that. Yeah, but you can read that in Tolstoy's book. But he's fabulating also a little bit.
And of course, there's instances too where the KGB secretly supported projects that
course.
Were distributed in the West.
Yeah. Any more questions? No?
No. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for your questions. Thank you. So if you have any more questions, you can always